October is designated as Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and while it's great to have a month bringing attention to the dangers that domestic violence creates, along with promotion of the help that exists for victims, it's also important to remember that domestic violence happens every day, all year long. That's why a piece of pending legislation that's making its way through Trenton is important, because of the way it addresses long-term impacts of domestic violence on children who witness it. Here to discuss what this bill would accomplish is the president and CEO of Advocates for Children of New Jersey, Mary Coogan. Thanks for being here today, Mary.
Great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Learn more about the work of Advocates for Children of New Jersey, how you can be a part of it as well through your support and activity, acnj.org. They have some great information and awareness-raising information as well. We have that link over at our homepage. For you listening, the piece of legislation we are going to refer to in the State Assembly is A2998, and the corresponding bill in the State Senate, S1774. And a lot of what this addresses, Mary, is something I bet a lot of people automatically assumed this would be part of the aftermath of a domestic violence court case, but apparently it's not so, is it?
No. So what this bill is going to require is that both the victim and the alleged abuser will be advised of any programs or services available for advice or counseling for minor children who are either physically present at the time of the alleged act of domestic violence or may have seen or heard alleged acts of domestic violence. So while there are many programs in New Jersey who have provided this service, it has not been mandated that people coming into court on a domestic violence complaint be actually given this information. And the other piece of this, which is great, is that they're creating a mechanism to pay for 3 counseling sessions.
That's important.
For the minor children.
That's important, too, because usually in domestic violence situations, it's the abuser is pretty much in total control of all finances, and trying to come up for the victim to come up with the money to pay for a lot of this care is next to, if not totally, impossible.
That can be true. I also think sometimes if people don't have the resources to pay, they don't seek the assistance, right? So this is at least saying, you know, this would be a good idea, and we have a mechanism to pay through the Victims of Crime Compensation Office.
Now, people, again, hear this and they think, go in the obvious, it's human nature. We're not going to fault someone for that. But this doesn't necessarily apply to a child who has also been abused, which does happen in a large number of these cases. If an abuser is striking their spouse, they're more than likely going to do or are doing the same to their child, as sick as it sounds. But there are short and long-term effects of just witnessing, for example, a mother being abused by a father or stepfather, and it sounds like this counseling, getting it as a requirement, a mandate, and faster than maybe normally would happen, is a great way to get ahead of those, the way that observing abuse impacts children.
Correct. So the research does indicate that kids who have been witnesses of domestic violence are at a greater risk for long-term physical or mental health problems. And I think by having these 3 sessions, you can identify if maybe greater assistance is needed, or a parent can identify if there is a concern that they need to address. So again, it's a positive step. Some of the data that I have seen is that there's over 10,000 cases of domestic violence filed every year, which involve children, right? So there are victims of domestic violence who file for a restraining order, but they don't all have children, but there are many who do. And just to point out to your listeners, we typically think of women as being victims of domestic violence, but probably about 25% of the complaints filed are filed by men.
As well,
too. They also can be victims.
And as it's also important to point out, too, that when we say domestic violence, that doesn't always include physical. There's emotional domestic violence as well, where you play, I guess they'd say, play mind games with somebody, try to gaslight, maybe a more common term. But it can be emotional abuse, not just only physical abuse.
Well, and even harassment.
Yes.
Right? People who are continuously calling either a place of employment or a home phone number, or showing up at a place of employment and creating an unsafe environment or just being disruptive.
I actually saw this one stat, too. According to a recent study, more than 15 million children across the country currently live in homes which domestic violence has happened at least once. And if you look at just the short-term impacts, depending on the age, it could be something a younger child will actually regress to things they were doing as they're younger, crying, bedwetting, things like that. If it's a teen that's observing domestic violence in the home, they will absorb that violence, almost become an empath to it, and then strike out in violent ways in their social circle, whether it be in school as a bully or get into behaviors like unprotected sex or using alcohol or drugs. So, again, remember, this mandate for counseling is going to, it sounds like it's going to expedite that child, whatever their age is, into more effective specialized treatment after those three general feeling out sessions.
Well, I mean, that's, I think, the goal of the legislation, but I also think there isn't necessarily trauma. Every child is not necessarily traumatized, but that doesn't mean that a check-in so that a professional person can explain to a child that this type of behavior is not acceptable and let them know that there is a service out there that can help them. I think kids will benefit from that.
Yeah, it's all
right. But you made a point earlier about this is not for children who themselves are abused, and so we do want people to know that if they have a reasonable suspicion that a child is being abused or neglected, we do have a hotline in New Jersey that they should call to make that report.
Now, I always say, too, people are always afraid of saying something because, well, what if I'm wrong? And this isn't too much of a stretch, I don't think. It's better to be wrong and apologize than to not do something and have to say I'm sorry as you're standing over a casket of somebody who you could have helped.
Well, true. And I also think sometimes it's the approach. So to the extent that you think someone might be subjected to domestic violence, to just indicate that you are there for them. And if they want to talk or they're looking for assistance, that you are available, can open up the conversation.
Tom Mary Coogan, President and CEO of Advocates for Children of New Jersey, ACNJ.org, their website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. I mentioned in the intro, too, the bill is making its way through the chambers of the State House. If you look at the Assembly Bill, A2998, current status, it's reported out of Assembly Committee, with amendments referred to the Assembly Appropriations Committee, which is a big step forward as far as, okay, we're going to fund it, and usually following that, they actually vote on it. There's a little delay on the Senate side. Maybe they're waiting for the Assembly to do their thing. But with S-1774, that's been stagnant now since May, as it was referred to then to the Senate Budget and Appropriations Committee. Still the right step and still moving forward, but a lot of work to do to make this bill come into law, which I think we all who have caring hearts hopefully will see that it will do. I want to talk about the work of your organization because you just don't put out information. You give a voice to kids who, yeah, granted, they don't vote, but they're part of our life, they're part of our future, they're part of our society, and they certainly have value that I think you magnify and help more people understand.
We try to. So we do that by sharing data through our Kids Count publications, which people can find on the website. And this is data that we collect from the census, from different departments and agencies to provide a snapshot of child well-being. And we encourage people to look at trend data to see if programs are working or maybe they need to be tinkered with or maybe we need to replace certain programs. So we take the data, look at best practices on a multitude of issues, and then advocate for effective funding and program solutions that we think will help improve outcomes for all children.
And I know have from experience of speaking with people from your organization over the years that without you, I don't think participation rates in the various school meals programs would be where they are today, because certainly when your organization started in your effort, the numbers were lax at best, and they've still room to go, especially with the breakfast programs, but they certainly have been headed for quite a few years now in the right direction.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, the fact that some of the numbers for the breakfast have dropped off. Our latest kids count really is showing that only 56-58% of kids who are getting lunch at school are also eating breakfast at school, so it's something we're going to be looking at. But that was an effort. We had a multitude of partners who really pushed for education to the school districts about the importance of breakfast and how they could serve breakfast after the bell. We worked with different state departments, Department of Agriculture, Department of Education, to make that happen and had great success. And in fact, that effort increased the number of children eating breakfast every day by over 100,000 and brought millions of federal dollars to the state of New Jersey. So the governor, with the support of the legislature, in particular our Speaker Coughlin, has expanded eligibility for school meals. So there's a higher income level. I think it's 224% of federal poverty where families can apply to have their children eat both breakfast and lunch at school. And we would urge parents to check out whether or not their kids might be eligible where they may not have been eligible in the past and make the application. Because that service and that food is available, and we know that when kids are hungry, they can't focus. And so we want to make sure that they get the meals at school if they are struggling to provide them at home.
For you listening, if you're not sure about whether or not your child will now qualify with the new rules and where the bar is set, hopefully your school district has that information on their website. If not, that's what the counselors are there for, that's what the vice principal is there for, and certainly the principal and superintendent as well, so contact them if you have any questions. Learn more about the work and the advancements and the information all provided by Advocates for Children of New Jersey. Their website, acnj.org. We have been talking with their president and CEO, Mary Cougar. Mary, thank you so much for the work that you do, the voice you give for our kids in New Jersey, and thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate your interest in these topics.